This podcast is sponsored by Sophie Reaptress, a one-person business based in Philadelphia. Sewing is Sophie's game, and so she makes cave suits, along with a lot of other things. But the cave suits is what we're here to talk about. She does a really great job. She does these really cool bat stencils on all of them. She can even do all kinds of custom things. I had her do the knee pad pockets because I thought that sounded cool, but she'll do breast pockets on both sides if you want. She'll do cave stencils all around if you want that. You know, little extra add-ons that make your suit unlike anybody else's out there. And she makes them the right way with super thick material all around and twice as thick where you need it. And you can see just how experienced she is when you check her out on Instagram at Sophie Reaptress, because she's got like 30,000 followers. Or you can go to her website, sophiereaptress.com. Get a cave suit. Get it in whatever color you want. She's got so many colors on offer. Unlike a lot of cave suits out there that just, you know, come in, what, three or four colors? She's got any number of combinations. Sophie Reaptress, get a cave suit and tell her the Caving Podcast sent you. This is the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser. If you are curious about caving, either for recreation or exploration, you've come to the right place. Or rather, your local grotto would be the right place. And I'll link you to the website for the NSS, which is our national organization, the National Speleological Society. And through that website, you can find your local grotto, which is like a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. We don't recommend that you go caving by yourself at all. In fact, we highly discourage it. And we recommend that you go with other experienced people and with the right gear, all of which you will learn or meet at a local grotto meeting, whether you go in person or virtually, just find one. And there is a link to the NSS website and how you could find your local grotto in the description of this podcast. So please check that out. Last month, we talked about the NSS convention happening July 1st through the 5th in Suwanee, Tennessee. I am officially going. I have purchased day passes for Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, plus a banquet. And so I am going to go. I'm not going to be there the whole week, but I will be down there probably on late Wednesday. And I would love it if we could hang out. I've already made some plans to go caving while I'm there, but I'm also going to have a lot of free time too. And I don't want to spend the whole time doing interviews, but I would like to get some interviews. That'd be pretty cool. But I'll be in Tag, man. And I'm usually in Indiana, not caving. And so if I'm in Tag, I want to go see some Tag classics and stuff. So maybe I'll see you there. Last month, we talked about the Floyd Collins musical coming to Kentucky early next year. And I've already begun making some loose plans on getting some panel discussions together to talk about Floyd Collins historically and also the musical itself. So look for those episodes later this year or early next year. Cave Week 2024. We had a little talk last month about Cave Week 2024, which is June 2nd through June 8th. And there is a link in the description of this podcast to the National Park Service website devoted to Cave Week. So check that out and see what it's all about. My own grotto puts on an event every year called Indiana Cave Capers, and this year it is August 15th through the 18th. I think it officially starts on Thursday, but otherwise it'll start on Friday the 16th. You can register by just Googling Cave Capers. It'll come up. But if you don't want to pre-register, you can just show up, of course, and we'll have registration open pretty late into the night. It's a good time at Indiana Cave Capers. I never miss it. And I'll be hosting the banquet on Saturday night, which I always enjoy. Love to see you there. If you like this podcast and you like the way I do interviews, I do another podcast too professionally through my job as a morning radio host in Indianapolis. Podcast is called WTTS In Conversation. And I talk to rock stars. I think cavers are more interesting, but it's fun. And more people listen to this podcast than listen to that podcast, which I get. You know, it's a radio station with a podcast. I mean, how many of those are out there? But I do have fun with that one. So if you want to subscribe to that one and listen to that one in case I've talked to somebody that you really like, we're closing in on quite a few episodes. That's an every 2 weeks kind of podcast. So that's out there if you want. So Katarina Kosich-Fico was an incredible guest. I loved talking with her about her genesis in caving and growing up in the classical karst of Slovenia and karst research, exploration of Omega Cave and Petra, the feline skeleton that she and a bunch of people discovered in Virginia. Really, really wonderful talking to Katarina. And thank you to previous guest Jessica Jernigan for hooking me up with Katarina. This was such a great talk. I am so excited for you to hear it. And stick around at the end and find out who's coming next month. Here's me and Katarina Kosic-Fico. Well, Katarina, it's wonderful to have you. Thank you so much. You've come highly recommended.
Well, thank you. I mean, I'm not sure why, but I appreciate the invitation.
What do you mean you're not sure why? You are a karst field scientist, a cave and karst field scientist at the Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation. And so I think you're a perfect person to talk with about this. So I would like to kind of go through most, if not all, of your career. But I want to start off in kind of a fun place. When was the last time you went caving?
Yesterday.
That's what I fully expected. Where'd you go?
To Huffman's Saltpeter Cave. We are doing bat counts in the winter. So it's the season where we go in the caves and look for bats and count how many we observe without disturbing them too much. And yeah, that's what I did yesterday. I saw some Virginia big-eared bats and little brown bats and tricolored bats. So it was fun. It was cool.
What is a typical trip for you? Would you say that is a typical trip, or what are you often doing when you go caving?
Well, I guess we're going to have to differentiate between if I go caving for work or if I go caving for fun.
Well, let's start with work, because yesterday sounded very much like a work trip, but I could be wrong.
It was. Yeah, yesterday it was a work trip. Well, they're not always the same, but in majority, they focus on basically, yeah, studying biology and biodiversity in caves, which is the main mission of our division of natural heritage. So most often we would go, so in the winter, obviously, as I already mentioned, we have bat counts and we have a set of caves that we visit and look for bats and see how their numbers are changing through time. And then more commonly, and we go to caves to look for subterranean biology, which pretty much means looking for little creatures, bugs, such as cave beetles, cave millipedes, aquatic fauna, such as isopods, spiders. So we spend a lot of time on our knees looking for very, very small, tiny little things, like between like a couple millimeters to up to like half a centimeter long. So very small.
So when you are doing this kind of work, my guess is you are oftentimes collecting specimens. And so what do you use to do that?
That's correct. Yeah. Well, we usually have a little brush and a vial with 90% alcohol so that it preserves the DNA of the specimen. Now with modern technology, the DNA, it's almost better than anything else to study these animals. But then for aquatic animals, of course, we need to get them out of the water. So we usually just use the turkey baster and fine mesh. And we just catch them in the mesh and then collect them.
And this is just, I would imagine, bioinventory. Or is the objective to find and describe new species?
It is certainly finding and describing new species, but also updating the existing records. I guess the division has a certain limit where we define a specimen as historic, which is 30 years. So we are trying to update them before 30 years so that it's kind of known that that species still exists. So it's both. It's basically updating the records and collecting new specimens. We do find a lot of new species on a regular basis in the caves just because they're not very well studied.
Once you collect this data, then have you, since analyzing it and, applying it to whatever it is your objective is, have you, in the years since you've been doing this, found anything that gave you hope for the biology of organisms that are in caves as far as their conservation and keeping them healthy as our impact increases on these subterranean environments? Or on the flip side, are you finding anything that particularly concerns you?
No, in general, we actually find a species being quite well, I guess, not protected, but like thriving in their habitat. We certainly had situations where, due to anthropogenic impacts, the species were threatened, but those are not very common, luckily. Yeah, I guess it also depends in which caves you're going and how close to basically, I guess, population and humans are. Obviously, if the cave is closer to humans, it's going to have more impacts. I mean, of course, we're finding new species everywhere, and these species are sometimes limited to one spring or one cave. And despite us trying to find them somewhere else, we can't. So those species are certainly more threatened, and it's a great concern that we preserve those springs and caves. Then you have different other species that are more abundant and found in various caves. For those, then it's a bit less concern, because usually if you're going to have an impact, it's going to be impacting one cave, very rarely a set of caves, except if they're connected. Yeah, we're definitely trying. That's one of the also reasons why we do this, is to try to update records in the sense of extending their habitat and range. And if we can do that, then we are certainly more concerned about, yeah, any potential human impacts. But as I said, up till now, we didn't have many cases where we would see the biology being completely depleted. There was one situation a long time ago, but they remediated, and now we basically have the biology thriving in that cave ever since. So I guess as long as we keep monitoring it and returning back and being informed as soon as an incident happens, then we can act fast. But of course, karst, it's beautifully complicated, which is the reason that I love it. So sometimes, you know, if there's something happens, it can't be remediated. And the only thing to do is wait that it cleans up through the system, which could be very bad.
I love that illustration. I love that you referred to it as beautifully complicated, because I think that most of us, even if we don't have a professional background, as professional a background as you do, I think that that's a lot of the reason why many of us go into these environments. But along those lines, what would you say is the greatest impact that humans have on these fragile environments? The first thing that comes to my mind is pollution. But in your professional opinion, what would you say it is?
Yeah, certainly pollution, particularly contamination of surface waters that are connected to groundwaters. I would say that's the main concern, not only for animals, but also for human beings. I mean, a lot of people, for example, here in Virginia, in the Appalachian Mountains, are actually using karst groundwater as the main water source. So if we contaminate it, it's not only those animals are going to be threatened, also people might lose their water source, including me and my husband, for example. Mm.
And so that is, it sounds to me like one of the biggest reasons that you do what you do, not only to take the bioinventory and to study the organisms that live in that environment, but also to study the potential impacts we may have on the water supply.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So basically, I guess it's the same as on the surface, right? Or in the rivers. If you see fish in the river, you're going to know it's healthy. And I mean, it's more likely to be safe for you to go swim in it, right? And it's the same underground. If we realize that a big community of aquatic biota suddenly disappeared or died, that means that the water must be very severely contaminated. So understanding the connections and being able to warn people that might be using that water, it's extremely important. In addition to just the fact that, of course, it's catastrophic and sad, but not only sad, I mean, for me, it's devastating to see that some of the species might get exterminated because of us, right?
Yeah.
I appreciate you filling me in on that, and we'll get to the other aspect of caving, the fun trips later on in the conversation. But I appreciated that intro into your professional life. So let's then go back and figure out how we got here. Slovenia is karst-rich country. Am I wrong about that?
Oh, no, you are very much correct about that. I mean, Slovenia is the birthplace of karst and karst science.
Etymologically, right?
Yes, yes. And my parents, and also where I spent majority of my life, was actually in the classical karst, which is called kras, which is the word from where the term karst comes from, right? They just adopted it slightly to be easily pronounceable. Yeah, I pretty much grew up surrounded by caves and karst ever since I remember. And yeah, that was definitely one of the reasons of why I want to protect it still and also explore it.
Do you remember the first trip, or was that too far back?
No, I totally remember it because it's still my favorite cave, in the sense of I just love going in it. But yeah, I do remember. So my parents brought me in this cave that was it's located on classical karst in close to village Pliskovica. And they were using the cave for dances. So basically, the cave, it's very small. It's basically one chamber, and it has a window on the top. So you get the natural light coming into this room. And to get into the cave, it's basically on the bottom of a very steep sinkhole. So they built stairs to walk down into this cave so that they could go in there dancing, of course, so they could access it with their nice clothes, you know. And they actually paved part of the cave where you see the remains of the electricity that they were bringing in. And to me, that cave was always just, yeah, a big adventure. Every time my parents said, let's go there, I was like, oh, yeah, let's go there. And there was this one passage that I really wanted to look at, but my dad looked at it and it was a bit steeper and muddier. So he never truly allowed me to go there, into somewhere. I mean, that passage was pretty much the reason why I always wanted to explore caves, because I was like, ever since I was small, I was like, I want to be so good that I can go in that passage and look at it and no one can tell me I can't do it. And I guess that helped to bring me where I am now.
So this was a drive that was very much, it sounds like, supported by your family. But after a while, I mean, this became a sort of a central focus of your life. Would you say, the turning point, when or where in your life?
Oh, yeah, that's gonna be a bit not of a fun topic.
Oh, okay.
So, so basically, I was always interested in protecting karst groundwaters. I studied political science, which it's appeared not have to do anything with what I wanted to do in my life, actually. But, you know, when you're 18, you're confused, you don't know what to do, don't know all the options. But then toward the end of college, I realized I want to do something else. And I was looking into the studies of karstology, which is actually, it's a doctoral study of karst science at the Karst Research Institute in Slovenia. So I talked with my uncle about it, who was also an important figure in my life, and was asking him, like, what does he think I should do? Should I go in karstology? Should I do something else? And he looked at me and he said, well, you know, the future is in the water, not in the gold. And that had a big impact on me, and made me kind of already being prone towards starting this study. But then a couple of years later, he unexpectedly died. And I later learned that he left me a small amount of money, which was just the exact amount that would cover my studies. And that was it. I mean, I just felt that, yeah, that he wanted me to do this and I want to do this. And he gave me the opportunity, despite that meant that he left me. And that's how I ended studying car science.
Well, I appreciate you sharing that. I mean, as sad as that is, it did set you on this path, and thank goodness for that. I mean, we all benefit from that unexpected tragedy because you're the one doing the work, and we appreciate him for doing that. We appreciate you for following the path that he wanted you to follow. So amid all of that, back home in Slovenia, what would you say were some other formative moments in caves that solidified this interest?
Once I started to work on my PhD, well, before that, actually, I met a now really good friend, Grega Mafi, who was a caver already. And he was the one kind of introducing me more into what all exploration entails and how to actually, you know, search for leads in the caves and what to look at. And so that kind of gave me, I guess, the enough knowledge and understanding that I truly knew that's what I want to do also in my personal life, not only as a career. And then I decided that I'm going to go to a so-called caving school in Slovenia. The cave clubs a lot of times these caving schools to train you to become a good caver. I chose Društvo za raziskovanje jam Ljubljana, which is my cave club now. They had a very well-developed cave school. Through this school, I met now a really good friend, Matija Perne, who was doing his postdoc in Arkansas. And so I got an opportunity to get a scholarship and go study in the U.S. And thanks to Matija and also Matt Covington, who became my supervisor in Arkansas, the University of Arkansas, I was able to join them. And then that's how I ended in the U.S. And I guess the whole perception of caving completely changed, right? First, in Slovenia, I was exploring alpine caves, very deep vertical caves with very minimal horizontal development. And then suddenly I come here and, well, the caves are certainly not deep and they're very horizontal. And I even remember at one point I was in Arkansas and Matt said that he's planning an expedition to Omega Cave System in Virginia, which is the deepest cave on East Coast. I wanted to join and he said, well, I want to see your skill. And he brings me to this cave and there is this guy that is going to be guiding us in the cave. And this guy starts that, yeah, that we need to stay focused, that the entrance, it's a, I don't know, I think he said 150 feet drop. And I realized I have no idea how much a foot is compared to meter. And he was so serious about it. He was like, yeah, it's like we need to be concentrated, careful. So I was just, oh my gosh, this is going to be what, like 200 meters, 400 meters? I mean, deeper we talk about here, right? Because he really was very serious. And so I look at this, Matija, friend of mine from Slovenia, and I'm all concerned. I'm kind of, do you think I'm going to be able to do this? And he looks at me and he's just smirks a little bit and says, I think you're going to be fine. So I start descending, right? And I come to the bottom of the shaft and I look at the other friend, Joe, and I'm, okay, where's the next rope? And he looks at me and he's, what are you talking about? This is it. And I'm, oh, okay. So obviously, then I kind of looked at Matt confusingly and he's, yeah, I know. As soon as you started descending, I realized, because he also finished the same PhD as I did and he spent years and years in Slovenia. So he is very familiar with our, I guess, what you learn through cave school. So he was just, yeah, I knew already that, of course, you can come to Omega. So it was an important step, I guess, because that's where I met my husband. And that's how I basically then ended in the U.S. permanently, I guess.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. Well, that's great. Well, there's a story. So you met him on a trip then?
Yeah, yeah. At the entrance of Omega Cave, yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, wonderful. You discovered a feline skeleton?
Yes.
Where was that?
That's in Lee County in Southwest Virginia. My husband, Mike Fico, was one of the instrumental cavers for the exploration of Omega Cave System, and he and several other cavers that were part of the exploration are convinced that there must be another Omega somewhere in the mountains of Southwest Virginia. So we spent a lot of time ridge walking down in Lee County, and one day we found this cave that had quite a significant amount of air coming out. So we were both super excited. We named it Buria Cave, which refers to a wind that blows in classical karst region. It's coming from the Alps down toward the Mediterranean. And it's very strong wind. So I guess in honor to that wind, we named it Buria. We started the exploration, and it soon turned out to be more like an evil stepsister, or maybe little cousin. Definitely not the sister, or nevertheless the twin sister. I mean, it's a very muddy, quite technical cave. And yeah, on one trip, there was actually a big group of us. We basically continued the exploration, and on the way out, we split, and some people left sooner than others. Sarah and I were following the first two teams that left, and on the way out, we just saw these little pieces of paper that Andrea wrote, and she was like, "Be aware, skeleton." Then another one, "Be careful, skeleton." And Sarah is, "What do you think it is?" And I was just tired and muddy and wet, and I was like, "I don't know. She's probably just, I don't know. She saw a bad skeleton or something. Just pay attention." And then suddenly Sarah pops out, because we had to crawl into this little hole in the floor. And she looks through this hole into the next room, and she's, "Oh, wow, that's big." And I'm, what do you see? And she's, "Oh, wow, wow." And she just goes on and on. And I want to see it go out. And so, yeah, suddenly when you looked out actually through that hole, there was this big skull just staring at you. And once you come out, you could see the whole, like the whole cat was fully preserved. You could see the skull, the vertebrae, legs, paws were even curled, you know, as the cats do when they sleep, tail, everything. And we basically passed it. I mean, we didn't see it coming in because of how the mud accumulated over it. And the only reason why no one stepped on it, it was that we follow the rule to follow each other's steps so that we don't stomp all over the caves and try to preserve them, right? Because, yeah, we could easily step on it. I mean, we were immediately aware this is a pretty big discovery, because, I mean, even if it is a cougar, it's 100 years since the cougars were recorded in Virginia. So that's how we discovered it.
But you also then, I guess, maybe later determined that it is probably from the Pleistocene epoch, and so it's at least 10,000 years old?
Yes, that is still the assumption. We named the cat Petra after a really good friend of ours from Slovenia, Petra Domainko. So I'm going to just refer to the cat as Petra from now on, if you're okay with that. Yeah, so Petra continues to puzzle not only us, but also paleontologists. So it seems that the upper part of the skeleton, because it was exposed, became highly calcified to the extent that we can't extract DNA and also can't date the teeth on that side of the skeleton. So based on that, it looked very old. But then when they turned the skull around, the part that was buried in the mud, it's actually fully preserved. It's beautiful. You can see the entire jaw with teeth and everything.
Wow.
So basically at this stage, we are still not sure. They are still leaning towards the same age, but they still couldn't date it. One of the main reasons is they're concerned that if they try to extract the tooth out of the preserved skull, there's a great chance that they would break it, and it's so well preserved that would be unfortunate. They also are still not sure what exactly it is. The skull looks very much like cougar skull, but the limbs are very long, longer than a typical cougar. So yeah, it's still puzzling them. At this stage, we're planning to go back in and try to collect more. There were a lot of little bones from small mammals underneath. So our thought was that we could date those, and that would give us at least the one part of the range of how old this thing is, right? Because everything underneath that is going to be older than the skeleton, since it was buried underneath the skeleton. So, yeah, at the moment, she's still a conundrum.
When was this discovery made? When did you find Petra?
2016.
Okay, so this is fairly recent then. Okay.
It is, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it took us several years to get the skeleton out because Dr. Alex Hastings, who was the lead and the only paleontologist that was bold enough to join us on this adventure, wasn't a caver. And Buria is a very technical cave, has a lot of rope work, and everything is so muddy that you really need to understand what you're doing in order to safely go in and out. So it took us 2 years to train Alex even to be able to go to the cave. And then COVID came, so that took another 2 years. So we only got the skeleton out in 2021.
I guess I'm kind of surprised to hear that it was extracted and is now being researched on the surface. How often have you come across something significant like that? Because in my experience, or in some of my experience anyway, I've heard of people leaving those things in situ. But it sounds to me like this was a significant enough discovery that they wanted it out.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, we find a lot of old bones in caves, but this is never, even Alex, we asked him as a paleontologist how many times he got a chance to actually extract such a perfectly preserved skeleton. And he never had a chance before to do that. So it is a very rare find. In addition, it is a feline skeleton, so there's very little known about, the life of cats in the Virginia and Appalachians. Yeah, we did get it out, and now it's at the Virginia Museum of Natural History. They are actually planning to, they did 3D scans of this whole skeleton, and they're planning to do an actual exhibit about Petra, showing it in full size and the full skeleton. It seems that we also did a pretty good job, luckily, at getting it out. So we had to break some bones, right? Because the skeleton was 6 feet long and the cave is very narrow and very tight. So in order for it to fit in the packs, we had to strategically break the bones. But it seems that we did a good enough job that, I mean, they even showed us, we went to the museum just this past year, and they perfectly match, so they can completely restructure the skeleton as it was, which I think it's really awesome. But yeah, regarding how many times, well, then we also organize yearly, if we can, expedition to Montenegro. And just a couple of years ago, we were exploring a cave that Tommy Kleckner found, and I was just planning to follow Penelope Worster to go down the rope, and I suddenly looked to the left, and I'm just, and she got scared. She thought that something's wrong with the rope, which, of course, I would never do that if something would be wrong with the rope. I would be more calm, but I'm just, oh my gosh, and I call her, and there was a mummified cat on a shelf, and it's also fully preserved. It seems to be modern cat, very small too. I mean, what's up with that? Like, now we're just seeing cats everywhere. So I guess maybe we just weren't so observant. I don't know. Or suddenly the cats are calling us.
Well, okay, back to Petra. Was it particularly far in the cave? I mean, I know how dynamic and ever-evolving caves and karst are, and so whether it was far back or closer to the entrance may not have mattered at the period of time when it found its way in there, but how far in was it?
It wasn't that deep. It's located 1,200 feet from the entrance horizontally at the depth of 115 feet.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Or was located there, yeah. So not that far in the cave and not that deep. The paleontologist actually saw some broken bones on the skeleton. So we are actually suspecting that it probably find its way in the same way as we do. The question is, was it actually using the cave as a shelter, or it was just an accident? That we don't know. There is definitely one part where a cat like that could go up and down that we can't. We, like, for us, the entrance, it's vertical. We need to descend a rope. But there is like a breakdown that, yeah, you could see a cat jumping up and down that thing. So that probably will remain a mystery. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to find out how the cat ended in the cave.
I mean, educated guesses is probably the best we can do at this point. Mm-hmm. But very cool. Thank you for sharing that. So let's get to exploration and things like that, which it sounds to me like you do a good bit of yourself. What would you say lit the exploration bug? Did that come first before the science or what?
Oh, yeah, it definitely came first. As I already mentioned, it was born when I was, I guess, a child. I don't know how old I was the first time I entered that little cave. But no, the exploration for me was always there. Ever since I was a kid, I just really wanted to know what's behind next curve, you know. And then the science grew out of that, of the love for caves, I guess, and also just through my PhD, meeting a lot of people that were really dedicated to studies of caves and karst, and, you know, showing me the ropes, I guess. So yeah, definitely, I'm definitely an explorer first and a caver first, and then the scientist second.
With that knowledge on this side, what are among some of your proudest discoveries?
Well, Petra, for certain.
Sure, sure. But as far as like finding a cave, which it sounds to me like you discovered the cave that Petra was in, right?
Yeah. And finding that cave was really awesome and really satisfying. Now I'm not sure about it because now it's quite a torture to get in there, but it's still going and we're still pushing it despite it's tight and muddy and wet. I mean, I enjoy exploring a lot of caves here, of course, and we do a lot of ridge walking and finding. So I'm also the type of the caver that, you know, wants to find the caves and then explore them. I prefer that I'm happy to help exploring already found caves, and I enjoy doing it, but I really, really like finding new caves. So we found a lot of caves. For me, Montenegro expedition, I guess it's the most fulfilling one, mainly because I kind of instigated it. I fell in love with Montenegrin karst when I started my PhD, and I went on a conference there. And then Mike helped me kind of decide on which area we want to focus. And it was kind of a joint decision that we're going to start an expedition down there. And luckily, had enough of crazy friends from here and from Slovenia that were willing to help us and go with us. A couple of years ago, as I already mentioned, Tommy Kleckner found this cave that we now call Fever Dreams. And the entrance was already pretty impressive, but there are a lot of impressive entrances in Montenegro. So until you don't go there, you know. But this year when we were, or not this year, but in 2023, when we were back, we actually made some major discoveries, including a 200-meter shaft that it's 50 by 50 meters wide. It's a massive, massive void underground, and it has so much air blowing out of it, and the same amount of air is coming from another canyon that is also massive. I think that we finally found something really big. So that was really awesome. I mean, standing on the edge of that shaft, and it was Mike, Jeff Wade, a friend from Britain, and I that discovered it, or were in the cave when basically our exploration led us to the edge of it. And yeah, it was extraordinary. And I can't wait to see what it does.
You say you go every year?
Yeah, we were trying every year, but this year we're going to actually take a break because we, it's hard to find sponsorship and support. And the cave requires so much robe that we usually get all the help from our cave club in Slovenia, which I need to thank very much for all the support. But I mean, they just can't give us so much rope. And additionally, they need the rope too. So we need to bring it back out. So we are going to just basically dedicate this year to try to find some rope sponsors so that we can actually continue the exploration. You know, it just requires, well, yeah, a lot of descending, a lot of climbing, a lot of everything.
Well, a lot of cavers listen to this podcast. So if anybody's got a hookup for Katarina, that would be really helpful. So what is it about Montenegrin karst? It sounds like there's a vertical extent that is very appealing, but if, I don't know, if you could blow up that picture, what is it that you love so much about it there?
Yeah, it's not the vertical extent compared to, for example, some other alpine regions. It's not even that big. So we're not, we're certainly not going to find the deepest cave in the world in this karst. I guess to me, it just appeals. It's very untouched and unexplored. And I mean, it's just fascinating. It has extremely large springs coming out of the mountain ranges that people still don't know where are coming from. It has extremely well-developed, basically, karst plateaus that have, like, I mean, some of the shafts you can actually see from the aerial photography. I mean, you go just look at the aerial photography and it's all just sinkhole, surrounded by these massive blocks of limestone. So it's very scenic. It's very intense, I guess. So those are the main things. But then once we arrive there, then also my scientists, I guess, came out because we learned the community that helps us and supports us there. It's located in this one small village. That village and three other villages are actually getting their water from one karst spring. And they need to drive. People need to drive with their vehicles to go get the water that they can drink. So at home, they don't have potable water. They only have water that they collect with rain. So it's also, I guess, just the hope that we would be able to explain a little bit better. I mean, at the moment, of course, we don't have very good or optimistic vision about it, because, of course, these people would like to have water and clothes so that they can pump it. But we are on the top of a 900 meters plateau, and I apologize, I'm using meters. It's just that
we can do the math. We
okay.
Yeah.
So it's tall, right? It's like what, 1800
right.
feet deep plateau canyon, and all the water it's coming out at the bottom of this canyon, right? So the odds are that the groundwater table it's going to be down there, but you never know, right? Maybe we're going to find a perched aquifer or something. It just kind of makes you want to try to help these people as much as we can. So that's the other reason why I really love going back there.
I love those reasons. Those are, I mean, that's not what immediately comes to mind for me as far as reasons people like particular areas that they go to. But then again, I don't have the experience that a lot of cavers have. And it's just great to know that that's why. I mean, it sounds like a multitude of reasons, but they're all great reasons for sure. Well, okay. So it sounds to me like you do a lot of caving in Virginia, of course. Across the United States, though, where else have you been that was particularly striking to you?
I've been to Wyoming. I joined an expedition that was organized, it is still organized by Pete Johnson, Philip Schuchart, and at that point, Robin Thomas, which is in the Bridger-Teton area on Forest Service land. And I love that expedition. In addition that we were kind of lucky again. We joined the expedition during COVID, which was, I don't know, like maybe second year after they started exploring the area. They found a cave that had they set an 80-meter shaft in there. And so they named that cave Loaded Dice because it had a drawing of a dice at the entrance.
Ooh.
And they decided that they're going to choose who's going to be rigging that shaft by throwing the dice. And because it was COVID, we were grouped in smaller groups and we stayed together, you know, to minimize any chance of just spreading COVID if we get it. And so our group won, and it was pretty much made out of Mike and I, who just arrived and never been there, and Philip Schuchard and Robin Thomas. And but then when we went to the shaft, Mike started to rig and was doing some cleaning. You know, it's always good to clean all the rocks. And one of the rocks fell on what we thought was the bottom, but it dislodged some more boulders. And suddenly we had a very, very big boom. And we just looked at each other and we were all, this is more than 80 meters.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was like, I think it's now maybe 150 or 160 meters deep.
Wow.
Yeah. So we suddenly are not only rigging a cool shaft, we're rigging a really cool deep shaft. So that was extraordinary again. Super fantastic. But also, I just loved the area where we were, and I loved the team. I mean, they really had a good group of people, so we always had fun, whatever we did. And I really do hope we can make it back there at one point. Of course, time only permits as much.
So internationally, Montenegro, back home in Slovenia, where else have you been?
Nowhere else, actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I stick to these two continents. It's mainly there are several reasons. First of all, of course, once you start exploring something, you want to explore that. But then it's also just the matter of my family back overseas. I miss them a lot. We're very connected. So every time I can take time off, I'm going to take it to go there and be with them. And that's why also... That's one of the reasons also why we chose Montenegro, because it enables us to spend time in Slovenia with them and then go and do some caving afterwards. And then, yeah, basically that takes all my free time. And so I don't get a chance to travel otherwise, unfortunately.
We all only have so much time, to be sure. How then did you find yourself working as the... Cave and Karst Field Scientists at the Virginia Department of Conservation? Obviously, your educational background and your experience, but how did that journey come about? What came before it, I suppose?
Yeah, well, once I met Mike, it was pretty much kind of obvious that we can't live without each other. So we decided to get married. And then when we were deciding where to be, either in Slovenia or here, it made much more sense to be here because I was still working on my PhD. And also my English, it's much better than Mike's Slovene, which was zero at that point. So I moved here. And during the time I was waiting for my green card, I wasn't really allowed to work. And I was just working on my PhD, which was pretty miserable. You're behind your computer all the time. And I met Will Orendorf, who is now my supervisor, and he was the main Karst scientist for Department of Conservation and Recreation. And he told me that if I would like, I can join them as a volunteer. So I decided to do that, which helped me a lot because I didn't only learn about Virginian karst and Appalachian karst, which is so much different than the Dinaric karst that I'm used of or was used of. It also helped me because in my PhD, I was studying protection of karst aquifers. So I was combining my political science background with karst science. And I was comparing the protection in Europe with US. And in Europe, I was focusing on Slovenia and Italy as two countries. And here I was focusing on Virginia and Tennessee. So it helped me also a lot with development of my PhD and helped me learn a lot. And then I guess from there, a position was open for a wage employee, so part-time, which worked great for me at that point since I was still working on my PhD. So I was working as a wage employee for quite a few years. And afterwards, a position opened. Like, we finally were able to get enough support. We were able to have another position, a permanent position. So I applied for that. Luckily, I was selected.
It sounds like a winding journey, just as most things are. Oftentimes you end up where you end up. But I am curious about your PhD. What was the focus? Because PhD dissertations can be very, very focused. And I know that this can get us into the weeds. And if it does, my apologies. But what were you writing about, studying?
Well, I was actually looking at the policies, so legislation about karst aquifer protection.
Really?
I was looking at the legislation in Slovenia and Italy, and at the legislation in European Union in general, because that gave me a better starting point to compare it with the U.S. So then I did the same for the U.S., Virginia, and Tennessee. So that was pretty boring. I mean, very boring. It's really, really hard to go through a lot of legislation. I mean, it wasn't the best part of my life, let's say that. But it was important. I found out some really cool stuff. But in addition to that, when I was in Arkansas with Matt Covington's research group, I joined Van Brahana, and he was helping a local community. So they placed a confined animal feeding operation. I'm not sure if you're aware of that term.
Yeah.
Big industrial farms. So they put a swine, CAFO, which is an acronym for it, in a karst valley. And basically, we were doing a lot of dye tracings to prove that it could have an impact on the not only groundwater, but also surface water in the area. Yeah, we were just kind of comparing what they implemented as prevention measures, and we're looking at how they could impact it. Additionally, that made me kind of realize that a lot of times we're kind of considering karst as a vulnerable landscape, right? But we usually think of it as a vulnerable landscape because it doesn't have thick soil covers. So a lot of methodologies that were developed automatically assumed as soon as you have thick soil covers, the groundwater is going to be protected. So I wanted to do a study where I was studying how long does it take for example, a nutrient that's being sprayed on the surface to come through very thick soil covers into groundwater. And that was mainly based on the realization that CAFO was basically spraying the manure that was coming out of this farm on pastures. And they were able to spray quite big amounts of this manure on the surface. And so my thought was, well, the soils can only attenuate as much contaminants, right? And then the rest is going to go through and still hit the groundwater. And so I confirmed that with dye tracing and also looking at the dissolution rates of limestone in comparing it with submerging manure and limestone submerging just regular soil and water. So that kind of helped me also prove that we shouldn't neglect the fact that karst is complex, no matter how thick soil covers it has, and be more detailed on how we study it and evaluate it and how we decide what management practices are the best. So I developed a framework, a very simple several steps framework on how you need to evaluate karst and when you need to bring in different agencies and different stakeholders, including the public. And kind of with this framework presented that you can actually develop good management practices by using existing knowledge and existing agencies and save money and time.
It sounds to me like you really incorporated your original undergrad of political science and it found its sort of way into your PhD work.
It did, yeah. And I think that actually, I don't know, as I see the interdisciplinary approach in, I guess, all science, but particularly karst science, it's extremely important. And I'm constantly trying to encourage students that have maybe social sciences background to get involved in study cars. Through my research, it definitely came more and more obvious that it's easy to look at it from one perspective, right? And we can't only look at it from scientific perspective, because then we don't account for the public and the impacts we have on the communities. And also, it's in that way we get unrealistic, right? Because, I mean, if we would be only looking at that, then basically we would just have to close all the cars' terrains and evacuate people or something. I don't know. It's just unrealistic. And that's why it's important to kind of complement the scientific knowledge with sociological and politological knowledge so that you can develop really useful methodologies that are going to help both communities and cars.
Well, and I think it's particularly important as well, because caves and karst, particularly caves, I would say, are so misunderstood, or there's not much of an understanding on the public level of the importance of caves and our impact on them from the surface. I think that communicating that in any way is very important.
Exactly. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You make a really good point. It is very important. And it is also true that, I don't know, a lot of times I would look at the car scientist trying to explain something to, I don't know, a local person, and they would just go in this scientific terminology and details. And I'm just, oh my gosh, this poor person is never going to understand what you want to say, right? So it's just kind of, yeah, it's important how we present our knowledge. And it's important that we present it in a way that it's going to be intriguing to the public, so that they will start feeling as one with cars and realize how important it is for them and for nature.
So we've talked about where you've been, both professionally and with regard to the recreation of caving and exploration of caves and things like that. What is still on your dream list? What is a goal that you have not yet attained yet? Where do you want to go?
Ooh.
I know that's a big question.
That is a big question. Well, I certainly would like to continue exploring Montenegrin caves, especially Fever Dreams. That's definitely one of the dreams, no pun intended. I would like to find Omega's sister. So I continue roaming the Appalachian Mountains in hope to do that. And as we were talking, I would like to join some other international expeditions. I would like to see karst, not only in Europe and in the US, but also, I don't know, maybe Mexico or China. I would like to explore some of that. So yeah, and maybe dive the cenotes just for fun.
Ooh, yeah, that sounds wonderful. do you reserve a particular time of year to have more time to do something, say, international, or does it just kind of come up when it comes up?
Oh, no, we plan it. I mean, you already see that. I mean, we already are planning Montenegro expedition for 2025. It's just, it involves a lot of work into organizing a caving expedition. People that join a caving expedition are not aware what all it entails. And if that is an international expedition, it requires even more so. I mean, it's like all the paperwork, all the gear, getting people there and back home safely. It's a lot of things. So, we plan things way in advance. The thing that come more, I guess, spontaneous, it's local exploration. But even with that, we all get so busy that we're trying to schedule things way in advance. But we are trying to go caving every weekend if we can.
So we're speaking at the end of February, and cavers probably won't hear this until later this spring or maybe even the summertime. And so I feel like I can ask, what is in your more immediate future? We kind of talked about pie in the sky dreams and where you'd like to go. But what are your plans for, say, this weekend or later next month?
This weekend, well, I'm going to go do some bat counts in Hellhole in West Virginia. And then I'm going to join, we organize this event through Virginia Department of Conservation and Recreation, where we basically offer to younger cavers to join us in exploring and studying caves for a week in Southwest Virginia. Our main goals there are basically trying to continue exploration of caves that, you know, there were a lot of caves that were found and never fully explored, and they still have leads. So looking into those leads and looking into new caves, maybe reserving old ones, and also looking at, can we study in caves? So that's going to be next weekend. So I'm looking forward to that. And then in May, we're going to Slovenia for a month. And a lot of our friends from the US, including Will Orendorf, are going to join us. And I'm really looking forward to show him particularly, because the rest of them already saw Slovenia. But I would like to show him my karst. You know, he introduced me to the karst of Virginia and basically contributed that I fell in love in it, and I never want to leave it. And I want to show him what I love about karst in Slovenia.
So that's coming. And
it is. It's exciting.
It is exciting indeed. Katarina, this has been wonderful. And I just can't tell you how much I appreciate what you do professionally, and how excited I am for what's to come. And I can't wait to read your name in an article in the NSS News or something like that in the future, and to continue to follow both your professional career and your exploration life. This is so wonderful. Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It truly was a pleasure. And yeah, I do hope you will see my name in NSS News, because I do try to write some articles, but I don't know. I'm just on caver's time, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Well, isn't that just the reality? It's just the way it goes.
Yeah, it really is. But hopefully, I mean, we are planning to publish something about Petra in the near future. So.
Oh, I can't wait. I want more details about Petra. Thank you, Katarina.
Thank you so much.
So wonderful talking to Katarina. Very much appreciated. Thank you so much for listening to this podcast and being part of the caving community. And I, again, will see you in Suwannee in July. Of course, I'll have a couple episodes out before I see you there, I suppose, June and July. Don't forget about Cave Week, link in the description. Don't forget about Sophie Reaptress, our sponsor, and our past sponsors, Swago, swagogear.com, Organic Robot Designs in Greenfield, Indiana, organicrobotdesigns.com. Elspelio Lights, now being sold by OnRope One. And next month, my guest will be Colin McGee, Canadian caver by way of New Zealand. Colin, I could not believe all of the things that he's done. I mean, I can't believe most of the things that all these amazing cavers have done that I've had the pleasure of talking to. My God, Colin is just on another level. And I can't wait for you to hear it coming out June 1st. I'm Matt Pelser from the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.